Welcome to Healthy Outcomes, brought to you by Baker Tilly, bringing you the latest trends and hottest topics in healthcare. Baker Tilly is a leading advisory, tax, and assurance firm dedicated to helping healthcare organizations explore ways in which they can win now and anticipate tomorrow. Let's go there.
Hi, my name is Mark Ross, and I'm the leader of Baker Tilly's healthcare provider practice. Joining me for today's Healthy Outcomes podcast is one of my Baker Tilly colleagues, Shane Lloyd. Shane is Baker Tilly's Chief Diversity Officer. On today's podcast, Shane and I will be discussing DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, generally, and we'll also be touching on some DEI topics that are specific to the healthcare sector. So Shane, I wanted to welcome you to the podcast. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Mark. I'm glad to be back.
You bet. So Shane, as we set the stage for today's discussion, and as they say, timing is everything, right? I wanted to share a few things that I learned and heard last week at a conference. I went to an industry conference last week. It was the Ziegler Senior Living Finance and Strategy Conference. And one of the presentations that I sat in on focused on advancing diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging among board and executive leadership in senior services organizations. And just so I give credit where credit's due here, Shane, the presenters in this session were Lisa McCracken from Ziegler, Jane Mack from Friends Services Alliance, Stephen Nash from Stoddard Baptist Home Foundation, and Rob Liebrich from Goodwin Living. A few of the takeaways, Shane, that I heard, and again, I'm not going to ask you to comment specifically on any of my opening comments here, but I think maybe you might be able to refer back to them as we're having our dialogue today. But some of the takeaways or some of what I heard during that presentation were as follows. PHI is an organization that ensures quality care for older adults and people with disabilities by creating quality jobs for direct care workers. And PHI engages in policy research and advocacy as the primary means to fulfill its mission. I wanted to say who PHI was first, because PHI released a report, Caring for the Future, the Power and Potential of America's Direct Care Workforce. They released that report in 2020. And some of the interesting statistics, Shane, in that report were that as we think about the consumer and as healthcare organizations think about their consumer today and their consumers in the future, that 23% of older adults in the U.S. are people of color. But by 2060, that proportion is going to increase to 45%. So the population is going to become much, much more diverse in the next several decades. In that report, they also talked about direct care workers. And direct care workers, by the way, are formally classified as nursing assistants, personal care aides, and home health aides. It's really a post-acute care sector type focused report. But 59% of direct care workers are people of color. 59% people of color. So our consumers are becoming more diverse, and the people caring for those consumers in a post-acute care setting are very, very diverse. And they also talked about the direct care workforce relying heavily on immigrants, and that approximately 1 in 4 direct care workers was born outside the U.S. So if we pivot away from the direct care workers for a second, Shane, and our future consumer, current and future consumer, they also quoted in this presentation last week a 2021 study from BoardSource. And BoardSource is a recognized leader in nonprofit board leadership research. And that study found that 22% of board members of nonprofit organizations identified as either African-American, Asian, Hispanic, Native American, biracial, or multiracial. And then Leading Age, which is a national association of not-for-profit senior services providers, in a 2021 report released by Leading Age, they noted that only 12% of board members of organizations were people of color. And that was really the focus, Shane, of the presentation last week. The presenters were talking about how senior services organizations are becoming increasingly focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion, with a really specific focus on boards, you know, those charged with governance, as well as their executive leadership. Because as you cascade down through a healthcare provider organization and you get down into that direct care workers, again, it's a very diverse population already. So again, I found some of these things interesting, Shane, and I just wanted to share them with you and our audience at the outset. But my first question for you now is going to be really just a level set question, Shane. And you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, it is defined differently. by different people, by different organizations. So can you talk about some of the ways in which organizations may define DEI? And as part of your response, can you also talk a bit about the evolution of DEI?
Excellent question, Mark. I'm happy to weigh in. First, I'll start with the various acronyms. Organizations might use diversity, equity, and inclusion. They might use inclusion, diversity, and equity, or they might include terms like justice or belonging. And I would say that you'll find that the most common definition of diversity focuses primarily on difference. Inclusion is oftentimes commonly used, but not consistently defined. And then equity is another term that, once again, is commonly used, but not consistently defined, and oftentimes confused with equality, which is not the same thing. My favorite definition actually comes from the Global Diversity Inclusion Benchmarks around diversity and inclusion. And it describes diversity as the variety of similarities and differences among people across various dimensions, and representations of diversity may vary by geography, time, and organization. Why I really like that definition is because it talks about similarities, not just differences. And then it also talks about, depending on if we're in Madagascar, Greece, or the rural part of the United States, how that concept of diversity comes to life will vary. And I think that acknowledgement is particularly important. When I think of inclusion, I like the definition of inclusion as a dynamic state in which diversity is leveraged and valued to create a fair, healthy, and high-performing organization. So inclusion is not just our interpersonal interactions, hi, how are you, using someone's pronouns. It also is this larger construct around our system. And without it, we wouldn't be able to effectively use diversity. And then I'll throw in equity as, you know, the fairness of access, opportunity, and advancement for all. And equity looks to identify and eliminate barriers that have prevented the full participation of some groups in a broader community. So thinking about access, level playing fields, and that our structures and systems may not be similarly accessible to all people or have similar impacts to all people, which I think the healthcare industry has been really thoughtful about considering in the work around health equity or social determinants of health. To your latter question around the evolution of diversity and inclusion, I'll start with my former life as a trainer on bias. And the concept of bias is to say that, you know, 40,000 years ago, when we were hunters and gatherers, there are particular things that we needed to do in order to survive. Now, fast forward, we're living in increasingly more complex societies, but still have that ancient hardware governing our life around there's a lot of information in the world. It doesn't have a lot of meaning. We have a need to act fast, and we're trying to figure out how to move through as easily as possible and without reducing our energy reserves in our brain, this complex world. I say all of that because part of bias is just having particular ideas that are more front of mind than others. So when we think of the evolution of diversity and inclusion, it is not uncommon for people to see this, think of the close association between affirmative action, equal employment opportunity, and civil rights as one of the hallmark ideas of the precursor to diversity, equity, inclusion, when in reality, diversity, equity, inclusion started, one could argue, started as far back as, rather, the precursors of diversity, equity, inclusion started as far back as 1870 with the establishment of the Department of Justice to help defend the rights of the formerly enslaved. And then we have, you know, civil rights, affirmative action. We have a period of time that one could call valuing diversity, where you saw all the cultural sensitivity trainings, thinking about how do we bring in underrepresented populations, whether they be women or people of color or people with disabilities, and ensuring that they assimilate, which is not the same thing as fully integrating, assimilate into the workplace. Then we had managing diversity that looked at, you know what, people from underrepresented backgrounds can bring and contribute really great things to our organizational environment. So that's looking at how do we bring together all these different cultures? And then you also see leveraging diversity, which is informed by, you know, different social movements, whether Black Lives Matter or the Me Too campaign. And one could argue that we're actually in a new phase around diversity, equity, inclusion, around belonging and social justice, whereby the shift has gone from not just affirmative action, not just cultural sensitivity, not just bias trainings or inclusive leadership, but DEI leaders looking at systems And how do our talent systems, recruiting, talent management, succession planning, how do they help or hinder people of different backgrounds' ability to thrive in our workplaces?
I appreciate that response, Shane. Actually, I know DEI has, gotten a lot of momentum, say, over the last, 10, 15, 20 years. It was interesting. You mentioned from your perspective, DEI arguably started back in 1870, I think you said, Shane, with the establishment of the Department of Justice. I don't know that anybody really thinks about that, but that is an interesting interesting way to think about it. DEI's been here for a long time, more than 150 years, I think you're saying. It just so happens it's getting, just a lot more publicity these days. Organizations are really focusing on it today more than they ever have before. Interesting. So moving on to the next question here for you, Shane. A number of organizations, again, regardless of industry sector, and I know we're going to try and weave in healthcare into our dialogue, but people at every organization that have a DEI strategy or trying to move the needle relative to DEI, I think want to get involved. Most people want to get involved and do the right thing. But I think, the work that maybe an entry level or a first year or second year employee at an organization can do might look different than somebody who's in the leadership of an organization, maybe the C-suite. So what does that work look like at each level, Shane? And how can people get involved in advancing DEI strategy for their organizations?
I am thrilled you're asking this question because I oftentimes think of the systemic approach to advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion necessitates two major prongs. Levels, looking at what is the unique work for people from entry level all the way up to executive, and then also junctures, looking at every juncture of the talent lifecycle from attraction to recruitment to onboarding to talent management and beyond, and thinking about how have we embedded systemic approaches that yield equitable outcomes that ensure all people can thrive regardless of identity. If I go with your first part of your question around what do people at various levels from entry level to executive need to think about, I think entry level employees need to have that baseline insights around their own self-awareness. How does my background, the cumulative experiences in my life, my own personal biases inform how I filter information or convey information to others, give feedback? How do I develop an inclusive mindset? And then how do I work on being an inclusive team member? Because regardless of background, everybody contributes to the felt sense of inclusion and belonging for everyone that they interact with in a workplace environment. And the consistency of the level of interaction informs the power of that. And if I'm going up the levels, there are specific things that senior leaders should be doing that differ from people at the entry level. At the senior leader level, what we need is for those roles to be focused specifically on the structures and the systems and the operating culture of the organization and ensuring that all of those parameters operate free of systemic bias. So as an example, if I am the leader of the recruiting function, I should be inspecting our talent pipeline from resumes received to offers accepted to determine, are there any points where people from underrepresented backgrounds are falling out for inexplicable reasons? Whether that's, we start with our resumes received and we see that something like over 40% of applicants are people of color. But once we get to offers accepted, only 29% of opportunities are going to people of color. That is something worth investigating at the systemic level because we want to be able to maximize all the diverse and qualified talent that is being received in our pool and ensuring that they have equitable opportunities to be considered and ultimately hired to contribute to our organizations.
Got it. Great response, Shane. And as I think about, again, those new professionals, new employees at an organization, the two things that you mentioned early on in your response was that concept of self-awareness. And certainly the self-awareness concept goes beyond DEI, right? But it's just being self-aware and then developing that inclusive mindset, which I think is so very critical in today's environment. So Shane, moving on to something now healthcare specific. So healthcare, as you know, and you've got a bit of a background in healthcare yourself, has a particularly complex workforce, right? There's hourly employees, there's salaried employees. We've got the C-suite. There's a number of vendors, outside vendors, contractors that come in and interact with healthcare organizations. And so I would imagine that just the complexity of the workforce could actually complicate DEI strategy a bit. Can you comment on that, Shane?
Absolutely. One important yet neglected dimension of diversity is functional role diversity. People are doing different things, have different credentials, different expectations based on the role that they occupy within an organization. And that has significant impacts both for content delivery around training, but also time and availability. If I think about hourly employees, they have a specific set of functions that they're aiming to serve, and they also have, depending on the country, a fair amount of time and attendance regulations that govern how they exist within the workplace setting. So when we think about taking hourly workers offline for bias training, we know that's going to have an impact on the financial plan because some will have to compensate those employees for their time. Additionally, we also have to consider, if we want more ongoing learning opportunities, are we embedding it within their day-to-day work, which also depends on what kind of work they're performing? Am I an hourly employee who's an admin assistant, or am I someone who's delivering consistent care where I'm interacting with patients and therefore stretched for time? Because those kinds of contexts around what kind of work people are doing and in what environment will determine how do we upskill them and what are some of the trade-offs that we'll have to make around patient service delivery in order to ensure that everybody has the tools, information, and resources that they need to help us drive forward inclusion.
Interesting response there, Shane. So, you know, when we talk about DEI, just strategies that organizations are executing, and it's not like an organization they don't have a DEI strategy yesterday. Today they have it, they flip a switch and everything's smooth sailing relative to DEI, right? There's a tremendous amount of work that goes into advancing. And even at Baker Tilly, you're leading the charge here for us at Baker Tilly. It's an ongoing process for us. It's something that we're going to be focused on certainly well into the future, right? For forever, quite frankly. But implementing these DEI strategies, executing them, there are some challenges that organizations face, right? There's a few headwinds. There might be some resistance relative to implementing DEI strategies in certain organizations. So how can those sorts of challenges, specifically maybe the resistance to it, Shane, be overcome or be addressed?
Sure. I think generally speaking, if we understand DEI as a change management project, it's not surprising that there's going to be various manifestations of resistance. And one of the philosophies I tend to operate by is engage in paradoxes and resistance. And by that, I mean, we should not be afraid of resistance. We should see it as a normal way of doing the work. And what we need is a framework to better understand the resistance. Is it coming from internal, a subset of our employees or across different levels? Is it coming from our external stakeholders? Is it coming from government officials? We have to understand what's the context. And do we have a shared understanding of the issue, or is part of the conversation that people have misperceptions or misconceptions about the nature and the goals of our work? I remember I was recently in a conversation where someone said, you know, I'm not sure I fully understand what we're aiming to accomplish with DEI. Are we engaging in political pandering? Is it to promote inclusion, or is it to promote profitability? And I said, and I did not take offense to the question. I think it's a valid question because not all of us are working with the same understanding. And I clarified, I said, what our goal around diversity, equity, inclusion is, frankly, a lot of goals. We want to create an inclusive environment that allows us to be an employer of choice. We also want to drive our businesses forward, which includes thinking about profitability. And we also want the organization to work effectively for people of all backgrounds. But if I'm working with different frames of reference or different cultural considerations, naturally that's going to create some kind of conflict in the workplace. And the ecosystem, whether it be psychological safety or shared norms around conflict resolution, all become particularly important. Going back to the broader idea of resistance, I think that there's Rick Maurer. He is a change management expert, and I really enjoy his framework around resistance. He says there's usually three kinds of resistance. It's, I don't get it, which means people don't understand the nature of the goals, the framework, the approach, and then you provide information to address it. I don't like it. Then you have to help understand, okay, what do you take issue with? And could we address that in some form or fashion? And then the last framework he says is, I don't like you, meaning I don't like you as the messenger for any host of reasons. So we need to find a new face to to convey the same message. And I think that when you have that kind of framework, resistance seems not necessarily less scary or anxiety-inducing, but easier to organize such that you can determine what might your response be. Could this be addressed by information? Could this be addressed by helping people understand that this doesn't need to be perceived as threatening? Or could this be addressed by having a variety of different messengers who can help people really understand how our investment in diversity, equity, inclusion connects to our business operations, and that it's not something that's bolted on, but something inherent to how we operate within our community?
Sure. So the concept of resistance, Shane, what I'm hearing you say is that the most important thing there is understanding the root cause for the resistance, right? What is the root cause? What is the pushback that we're getting so that you can effectively address it? It's just like the root cause for any issue. Unless you understand the cause, it's very difficult to make change to address it. Did I get that right? Root cause understanding and analysis?
That is right on, exactly. Because I'll give you an example. I remember I was talking with a leader about historically Black college and university strategy. And I said, one of the things that we have to think about is while it's really important to diversify Black talent, you also have to have some points of comparison. So for example, Deloitte invests, I want to say about $70 million with one HBCU for their making accounting diverse and equitable. $70 million is a sum that they can afford. But if, say, for example, I'm a middle market organization, I would not have that same amount of resources. So people might hear that and say, oh my gosh, are we going to spend this much money? And people might categorize that as resistance, but I actually see that as operational feedback. We do have to think about the logistics around the efforts that we're trying to put forth to achieve our goals and balancing those around the considerations of both our industry and the resources and the stakeholder risk tolerance, for lack of a better word.
Great example there, Shane. So let's pivot. Well, it's not really pivoting much. We kind of touched on it earlier, but leadership, right? Leadership in any organization plays a significant role in the execution of any strategy. But as it relates to DEI, can you talk a bit about the role that leadership in an organization plays in advancing DEI? And then what advice and counsel, you know, would you have, Shane, for leaders in the healthcare sector as they continue to focus on DEI in their organizations?
Sure. When it comes to leaders, I think it's important to think of leaders in two broad buckets. Who is leading your charge for diversity, equity, inclusion? And then who is working to support them, whether that be the chief operating officer, the chief medical officer, the chief executive officer? For the CDO role, that person needs to be well-resourced, both from a people power and financial resources perspective. They also need to be appropriately positioned, whether that be reporting directly into the chief HR officer or chief operating officer or the chief executive officer. So that way that role has both the insight and the gravitas to execute their strategy. They also need to have their professional development supported, and they need to have some really good measures that allow them to define and measure and benchmark the progress that they're making towards their strategy. And for the broader organization, the other leaders, one, need to be conversant in the strategy. They don't need to be experts in every detail of the strategy, but they should have their own talking points personalized to them and their experience and their role, making that connection between DEI and the business. Also, they need to ensure accountability, and not just accountability in the sense of promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion in their own talking points, but really thinking about a continuum of accountability ranging from rewards and recognition, also towards course corrective strategies if people are not just quietly being passive and not really proactive about the work, but if they're really undermining the work or not taking the kind of action that they need to, some consequence needs to be doled out to give them that kick in the pants to say that this is how we expect our leaders to behave. And also thinking about how do we integrate and reinforce some of the DEI concepts or the operating models into people's day-to-day work. Because I've seen a lot of organizations, for example, invest in either any number of DEI trainings, whether that's bias training or inclusive leadership, but they haven't tailored the trainings to the strategy. They also haven't tailored the strategy to the roles of the people participating in the training. Because when you have a really well-positioned training that assumes the day-to-day operating style or the day-to-day climate that our employees are working in, that is going to have a much better guarantee of reinforcement than the kinds of one-off trainings that are not tailored and essentially go in one ear and out the other. And then the last thing I will say for leaders is to also evolve their approach. I think of in 2020, a lot of leaders were talking about, hey, I'm listening and I'm learning, which is an incredible place to start and very, very valuable. But if we are heading towards the end of 2023, I hope leaders are not just listening and learning, they're also taking meaningful action commensurate with their role in the organization. I'll use an example. If you are a chief operating officer and you are trying to really do your best by advancing diversity, equity, inclusion, you have a number of choice options. You could help launch an initiative. You could steer a committee. You can head an inclusion council. You can fund different initiatives. You could mentor underrepresented talent to ensure that they're groomed to take on roles like yours. And the question you should ask yourself is two-pronged. What am I willing or not willing to do to advance DEI? And am I operating within my sphere of influence? So if you ask that second question, for example, if I'm the chief operating officer and I'm trying to advance DEI, am I applying a DEI lens to how resources are deployed across our organization? That would be a very, very powerful way to advance DEI within the context of the unique role that you play within an organization as an executive leader in control of managing how resources are deployed.
Shane, you're giving a lot of good examples here, actually, as you're responding to my questions. I'm sure our listeners will appreciate those examples. And I think the summary of it is, or at least one of the concepts you talked about there, was that if leaders aren't bought into or 110% behind any strategy, Shane, DEI just being one of many that healthcare organizations might have, I think it's going to be very, very difficult to move the needle on that strategy, right? So the leaders have to be bought in. They have to be talking the talk, walking the walk every single day, every minute of every day to make sure that the employees across the organization see them. I mean, leading by example, right? I mean, that's the bottom line there. So Shane, as we think about, again, DEI efforts, advancing DEI efforts, strategies in healthcare organizations, I think organizations out there, a number of our clients for sure, are doing a lot in this area, trying to move the needle for their organizations. But how do they evaluate success, Shane? It does seem to me you're certainly much more expert in DEI than I am, but measuring success, that could be a bit challenging, right? Or how do they go about doing that?
I love that question, primarily because it is not uncommon when people think of the concepts of diversity, equity, inclusion. For some reason, going back to the biases that people hold in their minds, there's this misconception that diversity, equity, inclusion is either squishy or not measurable, or only measured through demographic slices of the broader organization or specific levels of the organization, whether it be the C-suite or on-the-ground employees. And that's not true, because there are a variety of things that we can look at. Gartner, which is an amazing research think tank, they actually have a really handy tool called the DEI Metrics Inventory that pretty much has a non-exhaustive, but rather comprehensive list of all of the things that people could measure with regard to diversity, equity, inclusion. And some examples include, of course, representation, which is pretty common for a lot of organizations, but organizations could also be tracking, you know, when you think about your learning and development ecosystem, how many of the topics intersect with concepts related to diversity, equity, inclusion. When we talked earlier about self-awareness, there are a lot of different learning opportunities that connect with self-awareness, whether it's executive leadership development, thinking about ethical considerations or self-awareness or stakeholder awareness as a component of media campaigns or public relations or effective and integrist governance. You can also measure community impact. What kind of partnerships do you have with organizations, or what's the amount of money that you've donated, whether it be time, talent, or treasure? People who have supplier diversity initiatives, how much money have you invested? What kind of diverse suppliers are you working with? Are they primarily women-owned businesses, LGBTQ-owned businesses, or veteran-owned businesses, or people of color-owned businesses? When it comes to the number of initiatives and programs, what stripes and types are they? Are they sponsorship programs, mentorship programs, leadership development programs? And how do they connect to the work and processes? How are you measuring, you know, the speed with which you're able to deliver different kinds of service? Or are you measuring how quickly you can stand up new tools or processes that can help meet unique patient or stakeholder demands? those are a variety of different measures and metrics that people do not commonly think about.
We just talked about measuring success here, Shane, of DEI initiatives. So I'm going to share another comment or statistic, if you will, a metric that I heard last week at this conference. And I would like you to comment on it if you would for me, Shane. But research from Gallup, and this again, this was directly from a slide that was in a slide deck from last week's presentation. So research from Gallup and WorkHuman reports that 97% of HR leaders note that their organizations have made changes related to DEI, but only 37% of employees say the same of their organization. So when I think about that, again, 97% of HR leaders, and I'm assuming they're referring to HR leaders that have some ownership responsibilities of the DEI strategy, believe they're making progress. 37% of employees do not. I don't know if that would be, is that lack of awareness? Is that maybe some of the resistance, Shane, we talked about? But what's your perception, I guess, of that 97% and 37%?
It could be any of those and more. I would say that when it comes to anybody in executive leadership, oftentimes we are looking at the 30,000 foot view and 10 years ahead. And our job when we're driving for a change is to think through the information cascade so that people can clearly understand our goals, motivations, and how they can interpret or discern if progress is in fact being made, which also includes thinking about the PR and communications aspects of our change management strategies. But I think more importantly, we also have to think about proximity. So say, for example, we're rolling out a new amazing benefit for caregivers in our organizations that would help them get advice around, you know, how do you shorten the amount of time you have to spend grocery shopping, or how do you systematize this typical household caregiving task such that you can bring more of yourself to work, for example. You know, it's one thing to add the benefit in, but it becomes important for us to share, why have we added this benefit? Where can you find it? Is it accessible? I'll even use Baker Tilly as an example. One of the projects that we did last year was actually take a look at our health and benefits platform and reimagine it so that it's more accessible. When it comes to any kind of healthcare benefits, typically what people do is take out that massive PDF or book and look at the different benefits offerings and think about what works for them and their family members in conversation with their family members. What we opted to do was actually create a platform with filters for family, medical care, LGBTQ CAD status. So that way, if people went to our health and well-being platform, they could actually filter based on what's most important to them, and they have information around various benefits or workplace offices or groups that attend to those particular factors or dynamics. And it ended up creating a great deal more traction and attention towards our benefits page because it was more accessible and it was organized in relevant ways to the people seeking access to different kinds of benefits. So while people will still have that large PDF to navigate, there's also this easier method that they have to access benefits. So I think about that public relations, communications, but that proximity benefit where, you know, when people need it in the time they do, is it really easy to navigate and provides them the information in a snap of a finger?
Well, Shane, thank you for that response. And thank you actually for all of your responses to today's questions that I've thrown at you. And maybe I'd like to close with this, Shane, again, referring to the conference I attended last week. There was a quote on one of the slides from Arthur Chan, who's a DEI strategist, and I believe you know him well or follow him. The slide had four lines on it, and they read as follows. Diversity is a fact. Equity is a choice. Inclusion is an action. And belonging is an outcome. Very simplistic, Shane, right?
Yes, couldn't agree with those statements more.
I thought that just ending with those four lines would be a great way to end our dialogue here, Shane. So I appreciate the time you spent with me here today. And I also want to thank our listeners for joining this podcast. If you found this episode useful and would like to listen to more episodes about hot topics in the healthcare industry, please subscribe to our Healthy Outcomes podcast or learn more by visiting us at bakertilly.com. Shane, thank you again.
Thanks, Mark. Bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening. To receive notifications when new episodes are available, please subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcasts. For additional resources, check out bakertilly.com.